Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Front Lines of Freedom. Hoo-ah! I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. This past Friday was International Holocaust Remembrance Day, or the International Day in Memory of the Victims of the Holocaust. This is an international memorial day on the 27th January that commemorates the victims of the Holocaust, which resulted in the murder of one-third of the Jewish people, along with countless members of other minorities, between 1933 and 1945 by Nazi Germany, an attempt to implement their final solution to the Jewish question. 27 January was chosen to commemorate the date because that's when the Auschwitz concentration camp was liberated by the Red Army in 1945. Okay, joining me at the 50 caliber microphone today is Marine vet Skip Coriel. What you been up to, Skip?
Well, Colonel, I've been goofing off a lot this week. I've been watching a lot of TV series on Amazon. And it's odd that you should talk about Auschwitz and the Holocaust and all of that, because I just finished watching a series on Amazon called The Man in the High Castle. And if you've never seen that, it's the premise is that the Nazis and the Japanese won World War II. And it shows us what the world would be like if that had really happened. And boy, it didn't bode well for Jews.
Well, so I'm glad that that didn't happen.
Well, thank God. It's a good series, though. If people want to check it out, it's a great thing on Amazon.
Cool. Okay, here's what we have for you today. A news and comment by the Colonel. I'm going to discuss missiles and war, nuclear war. Then Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby will contribute his warrant wisdom. Colonel Chris Colenda will return to discuss his book on the next war, Zero Sum Victory. It's amazing. Then General Chris Petty will discuss STARS. That stands for Stand Together Against Racism and Radicalism in the Services. Next, Colonel Scott Fisher will present the Officer's Christian Fellowship, which is open to everyone in the military community, and will review the movie of the month with Diane Raver from the Garden State Film Festival.
Hey, troops, please invite your friends to join us at this time on this great radio station. Then head on out to frontlinesoffreedom.com and sign up for our e-newsletter. And join the conversation at facebook.com/frontlinesoffreedom.
We welcome your input to this show. Send us your ideas and comments through our website, frontlinesoffreedom.com, or do it on Facebook. Well, now it's time for news and comments by the Colonel on Front Lines of Freedom. Of course, we'll start with the news first. What's the first one, Skip?
Well, Colonel, starting January 17, veterans in acute suicidal crisis will be able to go to any VA or non-VA healthcare facility for emergency healthcare at no cost, including inpatient or crisis residential care for up to 30 days and outpatient care for up to 90 days. Veterans do not need to be enrolled in the VA system to use this benefit. This expansion of care will help prevent veteran suicide by guaranteeing no-cost, world-class care to veterans in times of crisis. It will also increase access to acute suicide care for up to 9 million veterans who are not currently enrolled in VA.
This is a very good move by the Veterans Administration. A very good move.
And Ukraine should anticipate more military equipment from Western countries soon. NATO said this month, as Russian President Putin lauded his soldiers after their claimed takeover of a Ukrainian town. A Russian missile strike launched on an apartment building in the southeastern Ukrainian city of Dnipro has caused the deaths of at least 40. The reported fatalities thus far mark the single deadliest attack on Ukrainian civilians since before summer of 2022. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg indicated that more heavy weapons are headed Kiev's way after it asked its allies for vehicles, artillery, and missiles it claims are essential for the fight against Russia. Quote, the recent pledges for heavy warfare equipment are important, and I expect more in the near future, Stoltenberg said. Indeed, he has asserted that guns are the way to peace. It is a paradox, but it is a brutal reality, he said, as he urged for Ukraine to receive more support.
Well, Stoltenberg is right, and European nations have to be the major supporters of Ukraine, not the U.S. We're in so much debt now that our grandkids are going to be hurt by it. I'm glad Europe's stepping up.
And earlier this month, the Department of Homeland Security announced an expedited deportation relief process for illegal immigrants who report their employers. To put it another way, illegal immigrants are to be rewarded for ratting out the American citizens who hire them. Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas labeled business owners who hire illegal immigrants as predatory actors and vowed to hold them accountable. The updated policy is an expansion of the principles Mayorkas outlined in a memo from October 2021 regarding immigration enforcement within workplaces. In a memo, Mayorkas said DHS is focused on delivering more severe consequences to unscrupulous employers who exploit the vulnerability of undocumented workers. One of the department's stated goals is to increase the willingness of workers to report violations of law by exploitative employers.
Wait, we're welcoming into our nation millions of illegal aliens, but we're punishing anyone who hires one of them? So we're punishing the illegal alien who wants to work to support himself and his family. How do we expect these aliens to eat and survive? This is beyond insane.
And on January 16 and 17, General Michael Kurilla, commander of U.S. Central Command, traveled to Tel Aviv to visit with the Israeli Defense Forces leadership. During the visit, Kurilla spoke with Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, the new IDF Chief of General Staff, about regional threats, opportunities to strengthen the U.S.-IDF military relationship, and upcoming training exercises between our forces. Kurilla also thanked General Kahavi, the outgoing IDF Chief of General Staff, for his leadership and commitment to the CENTCOM-IDF partnership. Kahavi oversaw the transition of Israel from the U.S. European Command area of responsibility to that of our Central Command. Kahavi quickly established a foundation for a strong, abiding relationship between the IDF and CENTCOM. Kurilla also congratulated Kahavi on his retirement after 40 years of service. Kurilla also met with Minister of Defense Yoav Gallant. The leaders discussed the importance of deepening defense and technological cooperation between their respective militaries. Finally, Kurilla visited the Israeli Air Force Headquarters and Air Operations Center, where IAF leadership presented him with detailed briefings, demonstrations of IAF capabilities and advancements, updates on regional threats and opportunities, and an overview of integrated air and missile defense.
Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and perhaps our most reliable ally in the world. We should be, and clearly are, working closely with them. That's great.
And a recent report found that fentanyl poisoning kills children under the age of 14 at a more rapid rate than other age groups in our country. Data published by the nonprofit Families Against Fentanyl suggested that children are being exposed to fentanyl, a deadly opioid, and ingest it by accident. While deaths from fentanyl poisoning across the country doubled between 2019 and 2021, there was a 300% fatality increase in children under age one. Looking at the record from 2015, FAF says fentanyl deaths have increased by almost 1,000% among infants. For children ages 1 to 15, the fatality increased by more than 1,400%.
And where does this fentanyl come from? It comes from China, carried across our southern border by Mexican cartels, who do it easily because of our unsecure southern border.
And three suicide drones recently attacked a U.S. base in eastern Syria, wounding two Syrian opposition fighters. No Americans were hurt in the attack. It was not clear who was behind the drone attack, but Iran-backed fighters in the region have carried out such operations in the past. Sleeper cells of the Islamic State group are also active in the area. Two of the drones were shot down, and the third struck the compound at Al-Tanf base, where the borders of Syria, Iraq, and Jordan meet. The drone that struck the building wounded two members of the Syrian Free Army who received medical treatment. There are roughly 900 U.S. troops in Syria.
Our troops are involved in many areas in the world where there is terrorism and war. We need to be grateful for our wonderful military. And that's the news. As Americans, it's our responsibility to ensure that our nation is well run and on the right path. Politics and politicians are confusing, but we can work together. Concerned Veterans for America can assist you, even if you're not a vet, in getting involved and getting our nation back on track. Working with them is one of the things I do. Check CV4A.org. That's CV4A.org. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. Coming up on Frontlines of Freedom, I'll share comments by the Colonel and we'll enjoy some war and wisdom. Then we'll talk with Colonel Chris Kalenda about future wars. Eddie's troops, take a break. Troops, if you ever have to defend yourself or your family with your firearm, you'll need legal representation. That's why I'm a member of U.S. Law Shield. They provide the best self-defense insurance that I've found. They recommend that you not even talk to the police without an attorney present. They provide unlimited attorney coverage as needed at a very reasonable rate. Check uslawshield.com, uslawshield.com, and use the code FRONTLINES. That's one word, FRONTLINES. You'll be glad you did.
This is Marine Vet Skip Correa with your home defense tip of the week. Neighborhood Community Watch was established by the National Sheriff's Association back in 1972 in response to the rising crime of the 1960s. You can form your own neighborhood crime watch by logging into www.nnw.org. Above all else, get to know your neighbors and work together as a community. This is just one more way to keep your family safe. For more useful tips on home and personal defense, visit homedefenseshow.com.
Fresh, flash, frozen from the American farmer every time. PatriotFoods.com, hit the shop now button. You're supporting a veteran family in need every time you shop. Look at us online, see how we give back. For the servicemen and women of this great country, we are fighting for the American farmer. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM, 10% off today, folks. Shop now.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. I buy Patriot Foods. It's great. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. It's 20 minutes after the hour, and you are in formation and listening to the front lines of freedom all across America. Troops, did you know American farmers are going out of business because folks are buying foreign food? It's not good for our nation's security if we can't feed ourselves. We need to maintain our food independence by buying food grown in America. Patriot Foods is not emergency food. It's food produced by our farmers. I eat it. I love it. Use the promo code FREEDOM and save 10%. Check patriotfoods.com. That's patriotfoods.com. Now it's time for comments by the Colonel. War never stays the same. The ability to kill keeps improving. The war in Ukraine has confirmed the arrival of a new missile age. This is characterized by a surge in global supply and demand for signals for both missile-based delivery systems and the means to counter them. In addition to the morale of the Ukrainian people and intelligence for targeting support, it's a conflict defined by mass use of precision fires. The threat of Ukrainian air defenses has impeded the free reign of Russian air forces, and the thousands of Russian missiles have done the same to Ukraine. All this occurs under a nuclear shadow and continued Russian nuclear saber-rattling. Hey, how well the threats of non-nuclear air and missile attack are handled will shape the prospects of future nuclear proliferation. This conflict's primacy of long-range standoff weapons, missiles of all stripes, confirms a much longer trend. Decades ago, the primitive guidance of Scuds led them to being categorized as a terror weapon. They never hit what they were aimed at, rather than one with military effect. No more. The diffusion of precision guidance and advanced intelligence and targeting systems have made them effective and indispensable. Russia has pounded Ukraine for months with precision missile fire, the largest volume of ordnance in Europe since World War II, exacting a heavy toll on economic infrastructure, military forces, and the population. Hey, this even as Russia has failed at combined arms in many ground assaults. And this is not just in Ukraine. Iran, Azerbaijan, and Armenia have used precision missiles extensively in regional conflicts. Indeed, offensive missiles are increasingly weapons of choice for Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran for use in conflicts to coerce or intimidate their neighbors in both peacetime and in crisis. Precision-guided standoff missiles and drones have proven decisive for Ukraine. High-mobility artillery rocket system launchers, which deliver guided missile launch rocket system rounds, have been especially effective. Just 18 launchers have delivered punishing effects on Russian forces. Anti-ship missiles have placed Russian ships at risk, most notably sinking the Moskva, the flagship of the Black Sea Fleet, last April. While commentators argue about supplying Russia with long-range army tactical missile systems, it's clear that even short-range precision fires, enabled by advanced intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, have considerably shaped the course of this war. We've been slow to take these lessons to heart. For decades, ours and other countries have taken air superiority for granted as sort of a kind of birthright. Investments in air and missile defense are not commensurate with increasing density of Chinese ballistic missiles in the Indo-Pacific or the potential for long-range cruise missile attacks against our mainland. We've had many warnings over the years in the form of drone and missile-centric wars. Hey, in 2014, the attack on Crimea, the missile attacks on Saudi's oil fields in 2019, and Iran's 2020 missile attack against our forces in Iraq. We were so confident in our focus on counterterrorism in rogue states that by 2012, our army had largely divested its regular force of short-range air missiles. A few years later, we reversed course and in 2016 made missile defense one of our top five modernization priorities. We've been scrambling to acquire capable defenses against both drones and cruise missile defenses. New capability will arrive in the coming years, but playing catch-up takes time. Air defense cannot win a war, but, and this is important, its absence can lose one rather quickly. The past negligence explains why much of our security assistance to Ukraine has been older weapons. Our army is stretched thin on its more modern air and missile defenses. Finally, in a major gesture of political support, we are now sending our premier air defense system, the Patriot, but only one out of 60 or so batteries. This may sound like we have a lot of them, but their capacity is dwarfed by the number of offensive Russian missiles. So, at the end of the day, the possibility of deterrence through non-nuclear means must not be taken for granted. Two decades of distraction come at a cost. For this reason, the challenges of the next decade will come against a backdrop of heightened nuclear risk. This new missile age is very much a nuclear age. If conventional forces are not produced in sufficient quantities to support a strategy of deterrence by denial, then the need for deterrence by retaliation will become increasingly necessary. In that world, nuclear proliferation to allies like Japan, South Korea, and even Australia may be plausible, even necessary. This doesn't have to happen. Ukraine has also shown that our conventional forces, including most prominently our long-range fires and air and missile defense, can be a powerful means to tailor defense and reduce rather than increase our reliance on nuclear weapons. This is an avenue that allows us to leverage its unique advantages with allies and partners. It will, however, take a concerted effort and nothing less than a renewed commitment to arsenal building. But if conventional deterrence doesn't succeed with sufficient missile and munition production, the alternative path will be bleak. The next missile age could be a dark age. Troops, be sure you communicate this with your Congress critters. And those are my comments for today. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. You're listening to Frontlines of Freedom, and now we get to enjoy some warrant wisdom with Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. What do you have to share this week, Roland?
Colonel, the U.S. Army is moving forward with a new microwave weapon to help provide air defense against incoming enemy drone swarms. The Army's Rapid Capabilities and Critical Technology Office has awarded $66 million to Iparis Incorporated to develop prototypes of its high-powered microwave short-range air defense system. The contract has the company delivering several prototypes this year with an option to acquire additional as needed, and it's all part of the Army's Indirect Fire Protection Capability High-Powered Microwave Program. I know that's a mouthful. That program is intended to provide a ground-based direct energy weapon that can acquire, track, engage, and defeat all manners of incoming threats, from cruise missiles and rockets to artillery and mortars to incoming unmanned aerial systems. This new weapon will join the other direct energy weapon, the 300 kilowatt high energy laser, that's been under development for the last several years. The difference between those two weapons is that the anti-drone laser is more like a sniper rifle, and the microwave weapon are more like a shotgun full of birdshot. So why the focus on more air defense systems? Well, time and time again, we've seen that the current air defense systems are not well equipped to tackle the threat of autonomous swarms of drones. And as this threat continues to evolve, our military needs to be equipped with effective countermeasures. You know, the surge in counter-drone swarm technology among U.S. forces is really not that surprising. In the years since the Islamic State began employing cheap, commercially available drones to drop bombs on troops across Iraq and Syria, drones have become the biggest threat to U.S. troops since the insurgents began using roadside bombs in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's not just the threat of militant groups using drones. In the years since Russian military invaded Ukraine, we've seen conventional militaries increase the use of drones. Even Russia has been using Iranian-made drones. For now, our soldiers will continue to train for future operations that involve going head-to-head with swarms of drones, and we need to continue to develop those countermeasures. For Frontlines of Freedom, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. Back to you, Colonel.
Straight ahead on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll discuss the next war with Colonel Chris Kalenda. Then we'll talk with General Chris Petty about STARS. All this is coming up I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. You're standing tall with the front lines of freedom. I'll be right back. Troops, it's time for sit-ups. Start with 50, take a break, do another 50, then stand at ease.
Nearly 30% of veterans have disabilities caused by military service. At Berry Law, we fight to make sure that every veteran receives full compensation for their injuries. Our team of attorneys, veterans, and former VA employees have helped veterans recover over $100 million in back pay from inadequate VA decisions. For a free consultation, call 888-883-2483.
From ending our nation's endless wars, to making sure veterans get the care they deserve, to addressing our country's out-of-control spending problem, Concerned Veterans for America is taking on the most important issues facing our nation. You can help CVA shape a better future for Americans everywhere. Visit cv4a.org to learn more, see how you can get involved, and join our movement. That's cv4a.org.
Troops, welcome back to our nation's largest military veteran talk radio show. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. This is Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, please do send me your comments and questions. Email me through frontlinesoffreedom.com. It's an honor to welcome back to the show retired Army Colonel Chris Kalenda. Chris was on the show last month talking about his efforts to treat veterans right through the Saber 6 Foundation. But he's written a book that is so compelling that I've dragged him back. His book, Zero Sum Victory, discusses why we failed to win a war after fighting for decades. And if we don't learn from our mistakes, we're going to keep repeating them. So thanks for joining us today, Chris. This should be good.
Thank you so much for having me, Danny. It's great to be back on your program.
Chris, start by giving us a quick review of your time in the Army. I know you commanded troops in combat in the Middle East. Talk a little bit about your career.
Sure. Spent 24 and a half years in the military in a variety of cavalry assignments. And then I commanded Battalion Task Force in Afghanistan on old Kunar and Nuristan provinces. And then after that, I was a senior advisor to three of the four-star commanding generals in Afghanistan and two undersecretaries of defense back in the Pentagon. And then the Secretary of Defense also asked me to be his personal representative in these talks we had with the Taliban from 2011 to 2013. So that meant declining a senior command and retiring from the government. But I thought that was how I could better serve. And so I accepted that role, did it for about 2.5 years, beating my head against the wall, and then resigned after that, started my consulting business.
Okay, so you were a combat soldier, and then you played a role in negotiating to end the fighting.
Right.
So you've got to focus on protecting people from harm from all kinds of directions. That's probably why your book is so good. And folks, the title of the book is Zero Sum Victory, but the subtitle is What We're Getting Wrong About War. And that's really what I want to talk about. Okay, during my 2 years in Vietnam, first as a rifle platoon leader and then as a rifle company commander, I fought many intense battles and we won them all. And during the entire war, there were no major engagements that we didn't win, but we lost the war. That confused me. And I was sure that there were some lessons to learn, but I didn't know what they were till I met you, Chris.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
So I guess I can blame you. Only a few will disagree that we have the best trained, best equipped military in the world, and our troops fight well. Right. But we've lost everywhere to poorly equipped, poorly trained forces in the Middle East. And we didn't do so well in Korea or Vietnam. Talk to us about the Middle East. That's where your primary experience is.
Yeah. Sure. Primarily Afghanistan. What I wanted to do, I had this opportunity to get a PhD at King's College in London. This was starting in 2014. And so it was after all of these experiences. And so I took the chance because I wanted to look at, you know, how is it that the world's best trained, best equipped, most technologically advanced, most expensive military can't seem to win wars anymore? And especially these small wars against insurgencies that we found ourselves fighting against in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And then you look at some of these other interventions, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, Syria. The track record is not very good. And so that was a question that sort of intrigued me is what are we doing wrong that is increasing the risk of these interventions turning into quagmires? And so I looked at three big military interventions against insurgencies, Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And one fiasco is a tragedy. Two fiascos is a horrible coincidence. Three fiascos, three disasters is a disturbing trend that requires some hard examination. And that's what we have. We have three different conflicts. We have very similar outcomes. And it's time that we started looking at what is it that we're doing? Certainly the enemy's got a vote in all of this. The host nation government's got a vote in all of this. But what are we doing ourselves at the policy and strategy levels that are increasing the risk of these wars turning into disasters? And it turns out that there are several common themes that if we corrected, aren't necessarily going to make all the problems go away, but they are going to reduce the number of own goals and unforced errors that we're making.
Well, that makes sense. And the purpose of our military is to kill people and break things. And if we're really good at it, we win wars and or it's deterrence. Nobody wants to mess with us. But then you add these small conflicts like you're talking about, and there's more to the game than that. And we're not there yet, are we?
Well, we're not. We do very well at the big wars. So we think World War II, for instance, we organize the entire country, our national security apparatus, our economy, et cetera. Behind that, we're very good at it. When it comes to these small wars, we are not so good at it. We're not very good at small things. And most of these small wars don't turn on battlefield outcomes. They turn on local political legitimacy. And so this is one of the key factors. If you were to do a kind of a double axis chart with insurgent sustainability on the north-south axis and government legitimacy on the east-west axis. So just imagine that chart. Insurgent sustainability means that the insurgency has external sanctuary and sufficient indigenous support to continue fielding a team. An insurgency that has been sustainable has been successful in every single time since at least the Second World War. It doesn't necessarily mean that they overthrew the government, but that they got most of their demands met. On the east-west axis is government legitimacy, which you can measure by the government's ability to retake and retain territory, population centers that are either contested or under insurgent control. So you would see a government being seen as more legitimate than the insurgency if they're able to retake and retain territory. Ever since World War II, a host nation government that has been unable to do that has been unsuccessful every single time. So when you put these together, you come up with what I call a critical factors framework, where the only time that you are likely to get a decisive zero-sum military victory in one of these conflicts is when the insurgency is not sustainable and the host nation government is perceived as legitimate by in the eyes of its own people. That's the only way you get one of these decisive victories. If it's in any other quadrant, then you're not going to get a decisive victory, and you have to figure out a different war termination outcome, different alternative. And most of that, your best bet is probably negotiating early to securing our United States interests, and then helping to you want to help advance the peace, whatever negotiated outcome.
Okay.
We arrive at, but not continue grinding away for decades.
I have said, and I don't know if this fits in well or not, that if we're going to get engaged in a long war engagement, I don't mean a 2-week thing somewhere helping somebody, that we shouldn't go to war unless Congress declares war names the enemy, and we know that defeating that enemy will end the war. And if we can't do that, we shouldn't go. Does that make sense in light of what you're saying?
Well, we've definitely got to have more skin in the game and more accountability. So what's interesting about all these wars is the presumption that they'll all be short, that we're going to go in with overwhelming military force, that the enemy will surrender or will succumb to that overwhelming force and we'll be able to get out very quickly. So in all three conflicts, there was a presumption that that they'll be home by Christmas, we're turning the corner, et cetera. One of the problems that you highlight is the fact that our Congress has been completely disengaged on these conflicts. They don't ask hard questions. They don't ask the right questions. One question we to begin with is, tell me how this ends.
Yes.
Tell me how this war is going to end.
And we need to discuss that, but we're out of time for right now. There's more to discuss about getting things right about war. Chris will stay with us. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Front Lines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for push-ups. I want you to do 103 push-ups. That's how many I do, well, some days. Then take a break, but stay in the area. Chris and I will be right back. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to veterans programs, mental health, and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code.
This hour of Frontlines of Freedom is brought to you by HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net is an online resource and information center dedicated to the welfare of those who have sacrificed for the freedoms, ideals, and morals we Americans hold dear to our hearts. At HelpVet.net, find information on benefit-related issues from education, healthcare, military pay, retirement, VA loans, and resources on education, finance, legal, health and wellness, the military life, moving and housing, travel and entertainment, and much, much more. Visit HelpVet.net, HelpVet.net.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. This is the final formation for this hour on Frontlines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with Colonel Chris Kalinda about how to win wars in the future. Chris, as we were talking about, since World War II, Congress has never declared war. In World War II, I mean, we even had rationing of gas and everything and food. The whole country went to war, not just the military. I have often said, and this is sort of what we were talking about before, in these lately wars, the military went to war, Congress went to lunch, and everybody else went to the mall. And that's not how to do it, is it?
When it comes to these small wars, you need much greater accountability from Congress, because we can't just keep throwing money and throwing time at the problem and hope it goes away. I mean, one of the big challenges that we have in terms of accountability is there's nobody in charge of our wars. So when you look at how the national security apparatus is structured, you've got the president. And then reporting to the president are members of the National Security Council, Secretary of State, Defense, et cetera. And then when it comes to these small wars, each of these cabinet secretaries deploys forces capabilities into these areas. So DOD will deploy conventional military forces, unconventional forces. The state will deploy an ambassador. USAID will deploy its aid development teams. The intelligence communities deploy their teams. And so when you get on the ground, there's actually nobody in charge, because everybody's reporting up their organizational silo to back to Washington, D.C. So really the only person that can make people work together on the ground is the president of the United States. And the president's got a lot going on, a lot of priorities to manage, in addition to a variety of different small wars. And so it would be a bit like having the Ford Motor Company with plants all over the world, but no plant managers, and every line director at those various plants across the planet reporting to different C-suite executives in Detroit. And the only person who can make decisions is the CEO. You can't run a business that way. You certainly can't run a bunch of wars that way. So we've got to get somebody in charge of U.S. forces and capabilities on the ground. So at least there's some accountability.
You know, that's a really good point, because while we'll have a commander on the ground who commands everybody in uniform, there's a whole lot of other folks over there, too.
And that's exactly right. Yeah. And you get this silo effect where the military will try to optimize in its silo, and it can have negative effects. So if there's civilian casualties in military operations, for instance, it'll undermine things in the governance side. If you try to optimize your intelligence operations in Afghanistan, we're famous for paying these warlords huge sums of money to be friendly. Well, what that did is it damaged the government, and it also created these perverse incentives where people would, for money, manipulate intelligence, saying that their personal or political rivals were Taliban or Al-Qaeda to induce us to go after them. And then it would create more civilian casualties. And so you had this problem of manipulation going on as well. And that happens when you've got nobody in charge. So you know you've got a silo problem when everybody is reporting that they're making great progress in their own silos, but things are going downhill strategically.
Yeah, I remember watching one situation where some troops were going out on patrol and some people came moving at them in a way that the enemy always did. So they engaged them.
Right.
Well, you're not supposed to shoot. If I'm in combat, I shoot it at something that looks hostile. Mm-hmm. I don't wait till somebody dies. That's what I do as an infantry company commander. On the other hand, from the political side, oh, wait a minute. One of the people shot was an assistant city mayor or something like that. And how do you keep those balls in the air? And that's what you're talking about, isn't it?
Well, that's part of it on a tactical level. And with our rules of engagement that I worked under as a commander, if you believe that there was hostile intent, you had every right to engage. I'm talking at the policy and strategy level. When we have the general saying, well, we're making great progress because we killed so many enemy fighters and we've trained so many local soldiers, and the ambassador saying we're making great progress because we've trained so many civil servants, and USAID people say we're making great progress because we've built all of these roads and things like that, but things are going downhill. And it's because we've got nobody in charge. We've got nobody setting priorities, nobody telling the military, the diplomats, the aid workers, the intelligence community, what to do, what the priorities are. So if you have a basketball team and everybody is, you know, the point guard, you can have a situation where everybody is doing their own thing, but they're not working together as a team. What was it? Team USA back in is the early 90s or something like that. Best basketball players on the planet, all on that team, couldn't work together effectively. And we got beat by a lot of smaller teams of lesser talent because they could work together as a team.
And that certainly hits the nail on the head, doesn't it? I mean, I don't care how good you are. It's the team that wins. And wow, this is just amazing what you're talking about, Chris. And I hope this is something, I trust this is something that our not just Defense Department, but our federal government is paying attention to, is thinking about. I don't know when the next war we'll find ourselves going into, but we have to go in with, what's that old thing saying? Doing the same thing over and over again, hoping for a different outcome each time is the definition of insanity.
Right. Yeah. It's unacceptable. I mean, look, you just look at Afghanistan. $2 to $3 trillion at least of taxpayer money, 2,325 service members killed, tens of thousands wounded, 20 years, and it all comes crashing down like a house of cards. Vietnam, over 58,000 killed. Iraq, we've spent, $4 trillion and counting, over 4,000 killed in Iraq. And I mean, this is not okay. These disasters are not okay. And what I'm talking about in zero-sum victory, things like putting somebody in charge on the ground, it breaks a lot of rice bowls. Nobody wants to hear that because everybody loves their bureaucracy. And the bureaucracies, the different Defense Department, State Department, they do great things, routine things routinely, but these kind of small wars are not routine things. And so you've got to do things differently. You've got to put somebody in charge. And there are other low-cost, high-payoff reforms that I discuss in Zero Sum Victory, that will help us, you know, stop making the same mistakes over and over again that are leading to these disasters?
Well, certainly we have to do that. If for no other reason, then we don't really want to send our young men and women out to get killed for no victory, for no purpose.
Right.
And that's not to mention the money we spend, and it's not the pain to the families and to the whole country.
We owe it to the people that we send in harm's way to have our act together. And right now we don't. It's unacceptable and it needs to get fixed.
Truly, it does. Chris, before I let you go, talk about your book and how people can get copies.
Sure. It's called Zero Sum Victory, What We're Getting Wrong About War. It's available everywhere. Awesome books are sold. So you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, etc. And please leave a review. Let me know what you thought of it. And this book won a National Book Award for Best Book in the War and Military category in 2021. And I hope it helps us create a language about and some practical actions on national security reform so we don't wind up in these disasters again.
Yes, sir. If you care about our country, folks, you want to read this book and you want to talk to your congressmen and senators and everybody else and make sure they read it too, because there's no simple solution, but there is a solution. It's not simple.
Right.
We need to make sure that in the future, we don't do the same thing over and over again. Chris, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for your service to our nation in uniform. And since then, thank you for your books. One last question. You have a consulting business right now. What do you do?
I help extraordinary leaders get good at getting better. So most extraordinary leaders, they love to grow and they recognize that 1 millimeter changes that they can make have a huge impact for them and for their organizations. And I help them make those 1 millimeter changes.
How can people touch base with you at your business?
Write me an email, chris@strategicleadersacademy.com. I'm also pretty available on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera. So you can easy to find on social media too. And you can also go to the website, strategicleadersacademy.com or the Saber6Foundation.com. Either one will get you to me.
Chris, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you. We have to stay in touch, bro.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you.
This concludes the first hour of the show. We'll start the second hour talking with General Chris Petty about getting racism and radicalism out of our military. Then we'll talk with Colonel Scott Fisher about the Officers Christian Fellowship, and we'll review the movie of the month, Diane Raver. Of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag, military history, and our self-defense report. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troop, it's time for jumping jacks. Do 50 good ones, grab some protein, rehydrate with water, and finally, put a big smile on your proud-to-be-an-American face and send me your thoughts by email or on Facebook.